From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time to talk politics with our regular commentators. The past week witnessed the shootings in Tucson, appeals for civility, a presidential speech, and what looked a lot like a presidential candidate speech. First, President Obama went to Arizona and delivered a eulogy.
And I believe that for all our imperfections, we are full of decency and goodness, and that the forces that divide us are not as strong as those that unite us.
On Capitol Hill, Speaker of the House John Boehner cleared the new majority's agenda for the entire week.
The needs of this institution have always risen above partisanship. And what this institution needs right now is strength, holy and uplifting strength.
And from Alaska, Sarah Palin lit into those who linked her group's campaign literature to acts of violence.
Journalists and pundits should not manufacture a blood libel that serves only to incite the very hatred and violence that they purport to condemn. That is reprehensible.
Well, joining us now, columnists E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of The New York Times. Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
And now that the eulogies have been said in Tucson and the Congress is preparing to return to normal business, I'd like to hear from both of you what you think is likely to be the residue of this terrible event, a change in tone or tactics or just a brief respite from our very contentious politics. E.J., you first.
I'd like to believe it would be a change in tone. I particularly liked in President Obama's speech his asking us to expand our moral imaginations, to listen to each other more carefully, to sharpen our instincts or empathy. So I pledge myself to listening to David more carefully and empathizing with him more. But I thought that was actually a lovely way to put it. The problem is that it's very hard, as conservatives correctly teach us, to break deeply ingrained habits. I've been thinking a lot about John Kennedy's great line, civility is not a sign of weakness. Mm. But if you actually look at the whole statement, he said, so let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. And so what Kennedy was saying, and I guess my attitude here is hope but verify.
David Brooks, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity here. I think there's an opportunity for a number of reasons. First of all, we may begin to see some symbolic gestures. There's a possibility that at the State of the Union speech, the parties will no longer sit divided. They will actually sit integrated with each other, which I think would be a good thing. There's also a possibility to begin to think about practical ways you could actually encourage civility. And I think that means the president finding a practical agenda that both parties can agree on. I actually think tax reform is something he's attracted to, that both parties sort of agree on the outlines. They have some disagreements, but they can begin to have a practical conversation about it. And then the final thing, and I think this is the most important thing, it's acknowledging your own weakness. I need EJ because I don't have 100% of the truth. I may have 60%, he may have 40, but, you know, we each have a share of the truth.
Now we know what this civility is all about.
Yeah. But we need each other to balance each other out, and we need the conversation. And without that conversation, we really have nothing. And so that's mm-hmm. why we need civility, because individually each of us are weak.
I just want to say, David and I both love Reinhold Niebuhr. He had an excellent Niebuhr line in his column today. One of my favorite Niebuhr lines on this theme is, we must see the error in our own truth and the truth in our opponent's error. That's a wonderful idea. It's awfully hard to run a campaign on the basis of that principle.
Speaking of that, it appears at this moment that President Obama is more popular than he was a week ago, and that Sarah Palin less so. Do you think there'll be lasting consequences for those two political figures, David?
Well, I think for Sarah Palin, there will be. Sarah Palin, to her credit, she was falsely blamed by a lot of people for what happened, for at least contributing. So I understand her point of view. To react as she did was so tonally off from where the country was, a country that wanted to come together and wanted that sense of leadership. She doesn't have a political strategy. She has a media strategy. And the way conservatives develop their media strategy is to offend liberals. And what she does is she continually picks phrases and things that will offend a lot of people in the country. And this is the way she rallies conservatives to her side. And it works as a media strategy. As a political strategy, I think even a lot of conservatives say, we may sort of like her, but she's not ready to be president. And I'm afraid she showed that again this week.
She faces a basic choice. Does she want to be a presidential candidate, or does she want to occupy a niche market? And I think that her response to this was someone who wants to occupy a niche market. Conservatives react just as David said they do. It was such an enormous missed opportunity for her, because it's worth remembering that the whole issue of the sort of gun sites on Sarah Palin's website really got into play because Gabrielle Giffords herself mentioned them in a March interview. And she could have, without ever admitting any guilt for anything, and I don't think anybody was directly accusing her, but she could have said, look, this bothered Giffords. I understand that. Of course, I didn't mean it in any of the ways other people might have said I did, but I pulled them down from my website. The fact she pulled them down from her website suggested she understood this at some level. She should have just said it, and I think she would have been so much better off.
Just want to get beyond Tucson for a moment here. David Brooks, the House Republicans, now in the majority, have their retreat this weekend. What are the questions they have to answer at their retreat?
They're asking practical questions like who's going to lead the party. Mm-hmm. But I think the real question they have to ask each other, they have to take a new view of Barack Obama. I've spent the last 6 or 7 months arguing with the Republicans, who is Barack Obama? Is he a quasi-socialist who wants to turn us into Sweden, or is he a moderate, pragmatic liberal? I think over the last 3-4 weeks, he's made it abundantly clear he's a moderate, pragmatic liberal. They have to take a new look at him and decide where they can work with him. And I think they're actually more willing to do that than one might suppose.
Do some Republicans say there's no such thing as a moderate, pragmatic liberal? You've created an odd creature.
I think I've heard from a number of them. They said, he's not as liberal as he was before. I think I'm becoming more optimistic there'll be less gridlock over the next year than I would have thought maybe a month or two ago.
EJ, thoughts on that?
I think that Barack Obama is kind of a protean figure, and I think there is a side of him that actually looks at Swedish social democracy, say, and sees a lot of good things in it. But he is not an ideologue, and he is, has both sides of him. And I think that liberals tend to see both sides and sometimes argue with him when he's not liberal enough. Republicans, until recently, perhaps, have not seen that. I'm a little less optimistic than David is, partly because I wish the Republicans could have kicked down the road having this debate on health care, which is still, by the way, called the Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act. I don't think they needed to debate that now. It would have been nice to kick it down the road a little bit.
EJ Dionne, David Brooks, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
This is NPR.